nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
My thinking about what we covered in the course, and it's sort of, you could think of it as an outline for studying for the final, I think. I won't have all the details in, but it'll kind of show you what we thought was important. So when you came into this course, you had 606 or 305, some beginning semiconductor course. So you knew what we call the semiconductor equations, and they're not quite as fundamental as Maxwell's equations, but they're the equations that people have used for a long time to describe semiconductor devices. And there are these three continuity equations that are just conservation laws, Gauss's law, and a continuity equation for electrons and holes. And then we have to put some things in there. We have to have equations for the generation and recombination rate and things like that. So those are constitutive relations. So these equations tell us something about how charge flows, and the drift diffusion equation does it more directly in terms of drift and diffusion. So what most of you probably knew about transport when you started this course is the drift diffusion equation. So for 50 years, this is all you needed to know if you were in semiconductor devices. It was just amazing what people could do. Still the case that for many, many problems, this is the way to solve it. And it's a bit of a concern that, many of our students can solve any GF equations, but if you encounter a problem where you have to solve the drift diffusion equations, we're losing that knowledge. You shouldn't. This is many problems, the right way to solve it is with drift diffusion equations, and that will continue. But the question with this equation is, where does it come from? And if we look at mobility and diffusion coefficients, how do we determine them? How are they related to material properties? How might they be engineered if we don't like what they are? That turned out to be amazingly important in the last decade when people started strain engineering to improve the performance of MOSFETs. They were engineering the material in order to get higher mobilities. Now, we wanted to know, what physics are we missing here? So if we encounter a problem, we know whether it's an equation or not. Then we wanted to know, what do we do if we encounter a problem that we can't use this equation for? How do we analyze it? So now, historically, I think this was first formulated, these semiconductor equations were first carefully formulated by a fellow named von Rosbach, probably in about 1950, 51, something like that. And then they were used for a long time, and then over the years, things were added to them. High field, hot carrier transport was added, field-dependent mobility was added, then velocity overshoot and things were added, and things just sort of got more and more complicated as this got smaller and smaller. Okay. So we took a different approach in this course. We started with very small devices in this Landauer approach and then worked up to the drift diffusion equation to see if we could get some insight that way. So, in this course we didn't talk about molecular electronics, but we were talking about really small conductors. And, people can make now small organic molecules between two metallic conductors. I think they measured the resistance of an H2, a hydrogen molecule. No surprise, it's 2 Q squared over H. But these MOSFET channel lengths are getting incredibly small these days. They're about 30 nanometers now. And they're going to get much, much smaller. So it's not at all clear that you should be using drift diffusion equations for devices like this. So we started out by asking, if we apply a small bias, that's the easiest problem, that's near equilibrium, low bias transport, what's the resistance of current flows? Okay. And we began with this Landauer model, and we eventually derived a generic model, and then we expressed it in this term. So you should be familiar with where this equation comes from. I think that was maybe lecture two or three. Lecture three right here. So you should understand where this equation comes from and what the assumptions are. Now, a key point is that if we have two contacts with two different Fermi levels, current will flow. We need a difference in Fermi levels. And then the key concepts we talked about was this M, the number of conducting channels at energy E, the transmission, which is a number between 0 and 1, which tells us the probability that they can transmit across. In this class, we calculated that classically. It was less than 1 when there was scattering, but it could be quantum mechanically. You could have a super lattice, and you could have to solve a wave equation to find out what the transmission was. Same equation would apply. We would just calculate T differently. And there are several assumptions, but some of the most important ones are this idea that you have these Landauer contacts, people call them. They're big, they're in equilibrium all the time, and they're absorbing, meaning that when an electron comes from the source and goes out the drain, it can't scatter in the drain and come back in the device. That would make it very complicated to analyze. And that turns out in many cases to be a very reasonable assumption. We also assumed that the inelastic scattering, where the electrons change energy, only occurred in the contacts. So electrons might come into the contacts and have gained a little extra energy from the voltage. They dissipate that and they come to equilibrium in the contact. No inelastic scattering, or at least not very much, in the device itself. We can have scattering, but not energy dissipation. So if we want to do the conductance, we said let's apply a very small voltage so that we think there will be a small difference between F1 and F2. And that means the second Fermi level is just a little bit lower than the first Fermi level because energy is minus Q times voltage, so we just apply a voltage to the second contact. We lower the Fermi energy a little bit. So when we do that, we can do a Taylor series expansion, and it's reasonable to expect that the difference between those Fermi levels is just going to be related to the derivative of the Fermi function with respect to energy. And then I have a Q times delta V so that I get an energy there. The dimensions are right. Both F1 and F2 are near the equilibrium value. I can't assume that they're the equilibrium value to begin with, or I would get zero. But I do the Taylor series expansion, and when I'm all done, I'm going to take the derivative of F1, but F1 is essentially F0. So I'm just taking the derivative of equilibrium Fermi function, and that's something we know. So we can evaluate that. And then when we do that, we get the conductance. So when the voltage is small, the current is proportional to the voltage, and the ratio of the current to the voltage difference is the conductance, and the conductance is given by these fundamental numbers, 2q squared over h, which works out to be 1 over 12.7 kiloohms. And then it's times an expression that involves the transmission, the number of modes, and this derivative of the Fermi function comes in because that's the way we wrote F1 minus F2 when they were close together. All right, so this is a really important equation. Right? And this 2q squared over h is something that is people didn't appreciate 20 years ago or so. But now it's important, even in MOSFETs. So, when we evaluate these integrals, things start getting messy. We get Fermi-Dirac integrals, and we have to do it for various band structures, and the math can get a little complicated. But, don't lose sight of how simple it really is. Even when the math gets a little complicated. Now, the easiest way to do this is at t equals 0, where the Fermi function abruptly goes from 1 to 0 at the Fermi energy. So its slope is negative infinity at that point. So minus the slope is positive. It's just a delta function at the Fermi energy. So it makes the integral easy. And when you do that, then this is easy to remember. This is like pi r squared, right? We don't forget this. So the conductance is 2q squared over h times the transmission at the Fermi energy times the number of conducting channels at the Fermi energy. And if we're not at t equals 0, there would be some kind of average conductance and number of channels around near the Fermi energy. And it would involve Fermi-Dirac integrals and things like that. If the conductor is ballistic, T is 1. And remember, this M is the number of channels. We just look at, we look at that energy and we say, we just count the number of channels that there are. Sometimes we can count them if it's a small nanowire, if it's wide or it's a big conductor with a cross-sectional area. We'll, you know, we have to look at the number of half wavelengths that will fit in, things like that. Okay, so we talked a little bit about the difference. When you came into the course, you knew about density of states. So then we introduced this concept, density of modes. So density of states tells us, we use that to find out how many carriers there are. We integrate density of states times Fermi function. If we want to know how much current flows, we integrate number of conducting channels times a derivative of the Fermi function. So we need both of those in order to analyze a device, because usually we want to know the number of carriers and we want to know how much current flows. So it's not enough just to know the density of states. You have to know the number of conducting channels, right? Conventionally, classically, people would say, well, I need a density of states effective mass and I need a conductivity effective mass. Of course, if you have the EK, you can get both of them, right? If we have the EK, we can get the density of states, we can get the number of conducting channels. So we only need an EK. In 1D, it's easy. We just count, you know, how many subbands are there at the Fermi energy. In 2D, we went through how that's derived. So you should review that when you're studying for the exam. But it makes sense. It's proportional to the width of the resistor. And in 3D, it's proportional to the cross-sectional area of the resistor. The bigger it is, the more conducting channels there are. So, and one of the points, you've seen density of states many times before, and you're familiar with the fact that we can evaluate it. Given an EK, simplest EK is a parabolic bands. We can evaluate these densities of states in 1D, 2D, or 3D, and they have distinctly different shapes, which leads to interesting things for device performance. We also showed that, you know, if you have a different EK, like a graphene EK, you can derive the 2D density of states because graphene is 2D, and you'll get something different because it has a different EK. But the point is, if you have an EK, you can derive the density of states. You can also derive the number of conducting channels, and it also depends on whether you're 1D, 2D, 3D, and the electronic band structure. So we went through that, and we showed if you have one subband, you just have one conducting channel in 1D. In 2D, it's proportional to W and to the square root of energy. In 3D, it's proportional to the cross-sectional area and grows linearly with energy. Okay, so it's important to understand density of channels and density of states both. Okay, so you can review lecture 4 about how you work this all out when you have a simple band structure. And then later on in lecture 17, we talked about what if you only have a table of E versus K, you know, throughout the Brillouin zone when you're doing a band structure calculation. Right. Then there's a prescription that we can use to do it as well. Okay, so ballistic versus diffusive. Sometimes students find it ballistic a hard concept to absorb. It's, you know, it's much, much simpler. It's just that in your previous courses, you focused on diffusive, so you're comfortable with that. The ballistic is a lot simpler. And, you know, we think about it in terms of this transmission formula. We've used this throughout the course. We derived it in one lecture. You know, when we don't have quantum mechanical tunneling and reflections, then we can compute the transmission this way. It's just mean free path divided by mean free path plus length of the resistor. And if the mean free path is much longer than the length of the resistor, the transmission is near one. We call that ballistic. Then we have a very simple expression for the conductance. And if it's diffusive, the resistor is many mean free paths long, and the transmission is much less than one. And we just get the ballistic conductance multiplied by the ratio of the length of the mean free path to the length of the resistor. All right. So again, it's all based on this simple formula, which you don't want to forget. Right. All right. And that also tells us, you know, we have an alternative physical explanation for, you know, why does the current decrease linearly with length? It's because the transmission decreases linearly with length in the diffusive limit. why does it increase with width in 2D? Because the number of conducting channels increase with width. And why does it increase with cross-sectional area in 3D? It's because the number of channels is increasing. It's proportional to the cross-sectional area. Okay. Now, when you came into this course, you were familiar with concepts like mobility and diffusion coefficients, not quantum conductance and stuff like that. But, you know, we're describing the same physics. So we can go back and forth between these two descriptions. Sometimes one is more relevant and more useful than the others. People are even extending these. I had some discussions with people at IEDM yesterday about ballistic mobility. We talked about that too. It's becoming really important, especially in 3-5 transistors. So we have an expression for the conductance that we derive. But before we came into the class, we were used to writing conductance as NQ mu. And much of the device world is still more used to that way. So we can map this, and we had a lecture or two where we went through this in detail. We can relate these two ways of looking at the same problem. Of course, if we're talking about mobility, mobility is related to scattering, so we're in the diffusive limit now. You can push this into the ballistic limit and define a ballistic mobility. We talked about that too. Some people are beginning to do more and more of that. But in the diffusive limit, we can work this out, and this expression, you know, might not look like NQ mu, but we can show that it is, and we can show that mu is Q scattering time at the Fermi energy divided by effective mass at T equals zero. If you're non-degenerate, then it's easier to work in terms of the diffusion coefficient and to get the mobility from the Einstein relation, because there's a simple relation, you know, that's easy to remember. The diffusion coefficient is this thermal velocity times the average mean free path divided by 2. And we know what the thermal velocity is, so frequently it's easier to start by computing the diffusion coefficient and then getting the mobility by the Einstein relation. If you're anywhere in between, then you've got Fermi-Dirac intervals and, you know, complicated stuff, but we can do that too when we need to. You guys should, you know, stop me if there's a question or something. But so, you know, what I'm really encouraging you to do when you study for the exam is, you know, I'm sort of giving you the takeaway message that you should have gotten from some of those lectures. Now go back and review them and make sure you understand the details. Now there's something else here that it's worth knowing. You know, sometimes you just remember in the back of your mind, yeah, I've seen this before, and then you go back to it. There are different ways that people write the conductance. So let's do 2D. So we would write the conductance as the sheet conductance times W over L in the diffusive limit, where the sheet conductance is the sheet carrier density, N sub S, times Q times mu. That's the way people would usually write it. Well, that's one way of writing the sheet conductance. Okay. In our Landauer way, we would just take this and express it in a diffusive limit. We would write it in terms of quantum of conductance, 2q squared over h, and number of channels, and we would get a different expression, two different ways of looking at the same problem. At t equals zero, you frequently see people writing it a third way, and we showed in one of the lectures here too that we can also, you know, write it. It comes directly from our Landauer approach. Conductance is related to the density of states at the Fermi energy times the diffusion coefficient at the Fermi energy. So when you see that in papers, it's not something new. It's just a different way of writing the Landauer expression. All right, but then getting back to our drift diffusion equation. Now, how does all of this relate to a drift diffusion equation? So we can show that it's the same physics. So if I go to a long conductor that has lots of scattering, I should be able to get a drift diffusion equation back. It's hard to start with the drift diffusion equation and find out what the ballistic resistance is. But we can start with a Landauer approach and take it in the diffusive limit and get a drift diffusion equation. So, you know, we write the, doing the Landauer approach, I have an expression for the current related to a small voltage across the sample. Current is related to transmission. In the diffusive limit, transmission is mean free path divided by length. The drift diffusion equation is for current density, so I'll divide by an area. And in 3D, the number of channels is proportional to area. So M divided by A, it would just divide the area out. And my transmission was proportional to L. So delta V over L sort of looks like an electric field. Now, when you apply a voltage, you lower the Fermi energy or the quasi-Fermi energy. So when you apply a voltage delta V to the second contact, you lower the Fermi energy by minus Q delta V. So I could think about this last term here, delta V over L, as being a change in the quasi-Fermi level. And if I think if the change is linear over this long resistor, then all this stuff in the brackets is just our definition of the conductivity. Delta V over L is the derivative. I took a Q out front, that is a derivative of the Fermi, of the quasi-Fermi energy versus position. So far, we've assumed the temperature is constant, so I'm just reminding us there. So, this is an expression for a diffusive conductor. Actually, people frequently call this, this is a very old and very general way of looking at current. Current is proportional to gradients of electrochemical potential. Comes right out of the Landauer approach. And now if I, say, assume non-degenerate conditions, I have a relation between carrier density and quasi-Fermi energy. I solve this equation for the quasi-Fermi energy. I take its derivative. I put it in this expression. And we'll get a drift diffusion equation. So it all comes out. If you're not non-degenerate, you know, then you get Fermi-Dirac integrals. Your Einstein relation is more complicated. You just get a more complicated drift diffusion equation. Okay, so drift diffusion equation is a limit of the Landauer approach in the limit of a long conductor. Okay, then we talked about what the driving forces are for current flow. Anything that produces a difference between the two Fermi functions in the contact will cause current to flow. And we've just been talking about voltage producing a difference. But there can be other differences. So the voltage changes the Fermi level in the second contact. So if there's a change in the Fermi level across the resistor, well, current will flow. But we could change the Fermi function by changing the temperature. So if there's a change in temperature between the two contacts, F1 minus F2 will be non-zero and current will flow. And we would expect that if the temperature difference is small, F1 minus F2 is going to be proportional to just the difference in temperature. It'll go linearly with the temperature difference. So we could do a Taylor series expansion. Then we could take this Taylor series expansion, stick it back into our general expression for current flow, and now it's just math. Right? We're going to get one more term in our drift diffusion equation. We're going to have a term that involves gradients of temperature. And we showed, we'd spent a couple of lectures, I guess, talking about thermoelectric effects. And you can just work out the math and see what the answer is. If we're thinking about how this works out physically, for example, Peltier cooling was one of the things we talked about. So we have two contacts. We have some energy levels. You know, let's say it's the bottom of the conduction band. Now, in order for current to flow, the electrons have to get up to that energy level. The current is going to flow near the Fermi energy in the metal. If the bottom of the conduction band is higher than the semiconductor, electrons have to absorb some thermal energy to get up there and flow. The average energy that they flow at is going to be a little bit above the bottom of the conduction band because the density of states is zero there, right? Number of channels is zero there. So it'll be a little bit above. They'll flow across. And then they'll have a bunch of excess energy that they'll dissipate. Then they lose all of that energy. The current flows in the second contact near the Fermi energy. So since I have one extra electron in the drain now, it's got to come out to maintain neutrality. Flows around through the external circuit, comes back in to the first contact, and replaces the one that left and flowed out. So it just goes round and round. Each time it goes around, well, I'm dissipating some net power, but I'm actually cooling the first junction and heating the second junction. And the difference between the amount of heating and cooling that I'm doing is just I times V. That's the net power dissipation. So this is the way we make refrigerators or power generation devices. So we saw that we could just work out that Landauer expression for small temperature differences and small voltage differences and get a current equation. But the electrons also carry this thermal energy. And we could do something very similar for the heat flux. So we have a flux of charge, that's the electric current. We have a flux of thermal energy, that's the heat current. And you know, both of them are going to have terms proportional to the difference in voltage between the two contacts and the difference in temperature. And we worked out expressions for all of that. Now, frequently people like to just turn these equations around and write them in a different form. Right? Same equations, you just reorient things so that you bring the voltage over to the right-hand side. And now we have voltage is current, is resistance times current, minus S times delta T, where S is our Seebeck coefficient. And heat current is minus pi times electric current, minus some thermal conductivity, penta delta T. Same equations, just rearranged. And it takes a little bit of math to show what these things are, but it just comes out of integrating that expression we have, you know, T of E, M of E, integrated over energy. You will see these expressions if you read papers on thermoelectrics. You know, these are standard type expressions you see in many, many papers. You usually don't see them written in terms of T and M. You see them written in other ways because they come from the Boltzmann equation, but it's the same thing. So when you need to compute them, we know how to do that. So now if I go back to the drift diffusion equation, I could take the limit, say, of that current equation for a long diffusive device and say, what does the drift diffusion equation look like now that I have a temperature gradient? There's just one more term, and this S sub T is called the Soret coefficient, S-O-R-E-T. Okay. And again, I could rearrange this. I could assume there's no concentration gradients. Then the gradient in quasi-Fermi energy is the electric field. And I could rearrange this and solve for the electric field. And I would get expressions that people use in thermoelectrics. I'd get an expression for the Seebeck coefficient, which turns out to be this Soret coefficient divided by the electrical conductivity. And we also have this Kelvin relation that relates pi and t. And we worked out these Seebeck coefficients for lots of different examples. We worked them out for 1D, 2D, 3D, degenerate, non-degenerate. I'm not sure if we worked it out for graphene, but you can. It's easy to do, right? We've got the expressions. It's kind of helpful to remember that the Seebeck coefficient is some fundamental constants, Boltzmann's constant, divided by the charge in the carrier, which is negative for electrons. And it depends on how high the conduction band is above the Fermi energy in units of KT, plus some little correction that gets complicated and involves Fermi Dirac intervals and things. But that little correction represents the fact that the heat is flowing a little bit above the bottom of the conduction band. Right. When you get degenerate, that correction gets big. But when you're non-degenerate, it's KT or something like that. All right. So you probably won't remember the detailed expressions, but you'll know where to go to work them out when you need to. Okay. So this brings us, the nice thing about low field transport is that we can assume that we're near equilibrium. So when we need to know the probability that a state is occupied, we use the equilibrium Fermi function. That makes things easy. We don't have to solve for it. So, you know, we know what the Fermi function is, and we can either use it in its full form when we need to, or we can simplify it when we only need to look at energies that are way above the Fermi energy, and then we can approximate the Fermi function by a Boltzmann distribution. And you know, we're used to doing that in the two limits. But what happens when we apply a larger bias and F isn't close to an equilibrium Fermi function? Then you have to either guess it, sometimes people do that, or you have to solve for it. And the way that we solve for it, we introduce the Boltzmann transport equation. So if we solve for that, if we solve for the Boltzmann transport equation, then we know F. And if we know F, we know everything from semi-classical transport. Because we can compute some, we can compute the current, we can compute the energy, we can compute any quantity of interest if we just define the appropriate weighting factor of momentum and then integrate over momentum. So once we know F, we know everything. And the way we get F, we started with this semi-classical picture of transport. So the first equation looks like dp dt is equal to force, that, you know, but p is h bar k, it's the crystal momentum. And we can track it in the particles in momentum space and in position space. It looks like we're tracking classical particles. We just have to account for the actual electronic band structure. And if we think about that, then we can derive this equation for the distribution function. And the way you do it is by computing the total derivative with respect to time. So there's a df dt, and then there's a df dx times dx dt, which gives us a velocity dot spatial gradient of f. And then there's a df dt times dp dt, the chain rule. And the dp dt is force, and then we get a gradient in momentum space. And that would be zero if there were no scattering. An electron would just follow some trajectory and position in momentum space, and it would never change. Except these scattering events knock things out of trajectories and into trajectories. And that's where things get a little complicated, but it's easy to write down what's happening in terms of these transition probabilities and the probability that there's an electron present to scatter out and there's a state empty to scatter. Okay, so we talked about solving this equation, and we talked about how in equilibrium there's detailed balance, so the net effect of collisions in any microscopic process is zero. And then you can solve it, and you find that the solution is the Fermi function, which is reassuring. And we can show some things, like we could show from that solution that the Fermi energy is constant in equilibrium. We always assume it is, but you can actually show it from the Boltzmann equation. It's constant. And we can show that the temperature is constant in equilibrium. That comes from an equilibrium solution. Now, in ballistic was really interesting, because in ballistic, the collision operator is also zero. Okay, but we're far from equilibrium. So that was an unusual situation. But it's the same equation. So what it means is that there's a Fermi function that also applies out of equilibrium. But the interesting part was that if you look inside the device, unless you have some kind of nasty business going on with quantum wells and things, if you look inside a device, you can divide the states up into two kinds of states. States that are populated by electrons coming in from the first contact, and states that are populated by electrons coming in from the second contact. And each one of those is populated by an equilibrium Fermi function. It's just that we have two different Fermi functions. So you have to go to every state in the device and decide which contact is populating this. I'll use the Fermi function of that contact. So we talked about that a little bit. So here's an energy band diagram of a MOSFET. If you go somewhere deep inside this MOSFET, you know, then you can look at those states and you can decide. The blue ones here are populated by the drain. So the probability that each of those states is occupied is given by the Fermi level of the drain. The red states are populated by the source. So if I want to know the probability that each of those states is occupied, I use the source Fermi energy. Okay. So that's the way things work out in a ballistic device. And I guess I'll return to that a little bit later at the end of the course. Let's see. Okay, so let's say there is scattering. Right? Scattering makes things really complicated. But it's not too bad if I can assume this relaxation time approximation, which is just a very simple way to describe scattering. So we looked at that. One of the things you should take away is that you can really only use this near equilibrium. Although sometimes people use it out of equilibrium, assuming that F naught is some symmetric distribution at a higher temperature. So sometimes you can get by that way, but it's much You know, it's much sounder near equilibrium. But even near equilibrium, it doesn't always work. You can only rigorously justify it when the scattering is either isotropic or elastic. And, you know, the difficulty is for semiconductors, polar semiconductors like gallium arsenide, the dominant scattering mechanism is neither isotropic nor elastic. But when you can do that, you can show that this characteristic time here is the, just the momentum relaxation time. So then we know how to compute it. So we solved this equation. We showed that if you apply a small electric field, then the first order, all it does is to push, displace the distribution. So this is what we call a displaced Maxwellian. It just pushes it in momentum space in the direction opposite the electric field. And then, you know, since we now have solved the Boltzmann equation, we can take various moments and compute anything we want. And we end up getting a drift diffusion equation. We can compute diffusion coefficients. We can compute mobilities. We can compute the characteristic times. We can do all of this because we've solved the Boltzmann equation. So the single bracket here means I'm doing an actual average over the equilibrium distribution function, since I'm close. The double brackets means it's a specially defined average. It's not just a simple average. And the special definition, for instance, this average scattering time is the proper average of energy times scattering time divided by the average energy. And people call it a transport average. Okay, so we have these two different ways, and we ask, you know, when should we be using them? Well, the BTE, we need an EK to use the BTE. We could solve problems like short ballistic conductors, but mathematically it gets much more complicated. It's harder to apply boundary conditions and solve it. So you can do it in the ballistic regime, but mathematically it's not so transparent. It works best in the diffusive regime when we don't have to worry about contacts and boundary conditions. It's easy to put B fields in. It's easy to treat anisotropic transport and get tensors, you know, a tensor mobility, a tensor diffusion coefficient. You know, but the mathematics can get a little messy. The advantage of the Landau approach, first of all, we've only discussed problems where we assume there's an EK, there's some kind of band structure. Actually, you don't need that. And if you've had Professor Dada's course, you've seen that. You know, we could do these small molecules where you don't have an EK. It works in those cases too. So that's an advantage sometimes. It's really easy to treat small devices with idealized boundary conditions. It works in a diffusive regime when the BTE works. And it's more physically transparent, I think. You know, when you look in the BTE, the result, you get things like DFDE, and you really don't know where it came from. It was some math you did to get the answer. When you look in the Boltzmann, you know where it came from. It was a way to represent F1 minus F2 approximately when you're doing the Landau approach. So the message is we really need both. And so we spent some time in lecture 17 in carefully looking at the mathematical relationship between these two techniques. People who solve the Boltzmann equation carefully frequently talk about some kernel of an integral they call the transport distribution. You know, you get something equivalent in the Landauer approach, and we learn that this transport distribution is just a product of transmission times energy. So in a lot of problems, we can just, you know, make a decision. Would I rather solve this with a Landauer approach? Would I rather solve it with a Boltzmann approach? It's important to know both because sometimes one approach is easier than the other. And frequently you're going to be talking to people who only know one approach and not the other. So you have to speak their language. If you're in a group and you're analyzing a problem and everyone knows the Boltzmann equation, then you would use the Boltzmann equation. We talked a little bit about B fields. Nice thing about the Boltzmann equation is we just include in the force a term V cross minus Q, V cross B, and now we've got the influence of B fields. We work that out. Mathematics gets a little more involved than doing it for just conduction, but we get J is a conductivity tensor that depends on the B field and how it's oriented. If we've got 2D, we have a simple structure that looks like this with off-diagonal elements. Those off-diagonal elements give us things that are important to know, like Hall effect. And we could write this equation in drift diffusion form too. And we end up getting an additional term that involves a cross product, which you'd expect because that force involves a cross product. Now, in stronger magnetic fields, we could work that out too. If you work it out from the Boltzmann equation, it's a little more difficult. We presented an easier way to work it out. And what we found is that the small field results work whenever the product of mu times b is small, which is equivalent to the product of the cyclotron frequency times the scattering time is small, which means, you know, in a magnetic field, electrons oscillate or cycle around the magnetic field at a frequency omega c. If they scatter many times before they make a complete revolution, then you're in the low field regime. And we derived that formula. We also did it for graphene. It depends on the band structure. Now, when you go to very strong magnetic fields, you start quantizing the density of states, you know, because these things going around the magnetic field, these electron orbits are like harmonic oscillators. The energy is going to be quantized quantum mechanically. And the states then get broken up into these Landau levels, and we start seeing interesting things like Shubnikov-de-Haas oscillations. And you should be aware that these exist and that, you know, you can work through the mathematics when you need to, because it's a commonly used thing to characterize semiconductor devices. Okay, we talked a little bit about scattering, about how you derive this formula for transmission, about how the mean free path is related to scattering time. You know, there's some numerical factors there, pi over 2 and things like that, that we had to worry about. You know, and remember, the particular mean-free path that we're using is a mean-free path for backscattering. It's a mean-free path that gives us a transmission of 1/2 when the sample is the length of the mean-free path. And it's the mean-free path that fits into the Landauer picture. There are other ways that people define mean-free paths, and you have to be careful about that when you're talking with other people or with working with them. Now, we also wanted to know how we compute these transmission probabilities of an electron scattering from P prime to P. And more generally, we wanted to know how we treat the physical effects of scattering. So the easiest way physically is through these characteristic times. So we got a physical picture for what the scattering time looks like, for what momentum relaxation time means, for what energy relaxation time means. And we saw that if we just knew that transition rate, S of P, P prime, and weighted it by the fractional change in whatever quantity we're interested in, that we could compute the relaxation time for that quantity. These are microscopic relaxation times. You know, later on in the balance equations, we average these over a whole distribution of momentum. Those are people would call macroscopic relaxation times. Okay, we spent a few lectures on using Fermi's golden rule. So we presented the standard prescription that people use for quantum mechanically computing the transition rate from a state P to a P prime interacting with some scattering potential, which, and, you know, the scattering potential may be static, in which case we have elastic scattering, or time varying, in which case we have inelastic scattering. And we saw that generally for simple scattering processes, the scattering rate is proportional to the density of final states, which makes physical sense. You know, if we have many states that we can scatter to, we just add up all the probabilities of scattering to those states and we get more scattering probability. Mechanisms that have charged impurities or electrostatic interactions like polar optical phonon scatterings prefer to send them to some states and not to other states to deflect them by small angles. So then you don't see this simple proportionality to the density of final states. Okay, so we talked a little bit about all the various ways that electrons can be scattered. They can be scattered by defects of different kinds. One carrier can scatter another carrier. Phonons can scatter carriers. There are lots of different mechanisms that can be that can scatter carriers. And when you're working on a problem, it's important to think about what are the important mechanisms for the problem that I'm working on, and then how do we go about scattering them. And the carriers can also screen the electrostatic interactions. So they're coupled to some of the scattering processes. So we talked a bit about, the general features of scattering in covalent versus polar semiconductors. And we saw that in covalent semiconductors, the scattering rate just increases more or less smoothly as the density of states near the bottom of the conduction band. But in polar semiconductors, we have these very strong polar optical phonon absorptions and emissions, and we can get some distinctly different scattering rates. And we also showed how in quantum wells, the dimensionality changes the density of final states, so we can get some distinctly different looking scattering rates. Okay, I'm going to squeeze 5 more minutes out because people are lining up at the door. Let's go back to the BTE then. We're trying to solve the BTE, and we saw if we know F, we could compute anything we're interested in. These quantities that we're interested in ultimately have to satisfy some kind of continuity equation. Every physical quantity will satisfy one. So what we did was to derive a prescription for generating a continuity equation for any physical quantity that we might be interested in directly from the Boltzmann equation. And that we can do very clearly, nice mathematical prescription. But you can't really use it until you find a way to simplify it. And that's where the art comes in all of this, is simplifying it. So for example, we could define a phi, and we could develop a balance equation for current, and we get a drift diffusion equation. It looks somewhat more complicated than the one we saw in our beginning course. But it's more or less rigorous. But all of these parameters depend on the distribution function that we don't know. So to use it, we make approximations, and that this tensor W is diagonal, maybe that we're near equilibrium, maybe that we have slow variations in time and space. So the idea is, if we write a balance equation for the electron density, we get the current density. If we write a balance equation for the current density, we get a tensor W, which is related to the energy. If we write a balance equation for the energy, we get the energy flux. If we write a balance equation for the energy flux, we get something that doesn't even have a name. So at some point, we always have to stop and terminate this hierarchy and simplify the equations. Now, one way to get around that is to do a Monte Carlo simulation. And what a Monte Carlo simulation does is just track these trajectories under the influence of the electric field. They move in position, they move in momentum, and they scatter frequently. And we just track them on a computer, and we average the results, and we've got a solution to the Boltzmann equation. So we select some random numbers to appropriately do that. Okay, so that was all the methods in the course. Then we ended up the course by trying to talk about, get an understanding of some general features of carrier transport. So in the bulk, the velocity versus field curves are distinctly different for silicon and gallium arsenide. We could understand this from the two balance equations. Input power is dissipated through scattering. Velocity is mobility times electric field. The scattering time gets shorter as the energy increases. So we could qualitatively, just by looking at the band structure and scattering mechanisms, understand the features of those curves. And you should review and understand that qualitative picture. Then we could go back and argue that when the fields varied slowly, there's a one-to-one mapping between the electric field and the distribution function. So when the electric field varies slowly, we could use our drift diffusion equation with field-dependent parameters. But when the electric field varies rapidly, we have all kinds of funny business going on. We get velocity overshoot, and it inherently occurs because there's a difference between energy and momentum relaxation. So this occurs very significantly in very short devices, and it's one of the most challenging problems of semi-classical transport. Okay, we talked a little bit about ballistic and diffusive. So you understand diffusive, we have a random walk. Ballistic, we just shoot electrons across the device. And the final thing I want to talk about before they break down the door for me here is we saw way back in the Boltzmann equation that the Inside the device, there's a local density of states. Some states can be filled by the source. Some states can be filled by the drain. That's a semi-classical concept. Now, quantum mechanically, our prescription for the density of states has to change. We have to weight this sum by psi star psi, and we can get tunneling, and we can get interference effects. We're still going to get a local density of states, but if you go to conferences and things and listen to papers, you can see these local densities of states having very complicated structures. So this is why I'm asking you to view those two lectures online, so that it's important to know what happens when this semi-classical Landauer and Boltzmann picture that we talk about doesn't work. All right. Very similar things happen for quantum transport. We just get more complicated local density of states and things, and sometimes you have to do that. Okay, so we started with the drift diffusion equation. The important point is it's still really useful. You need to understand it well. It often is the best way to solve a problem. Don't write any GF equations when you should be writing drift diffusion equations. We've taught you how you compute mobility and diffusion coefficients. We've given you some understanding of what assumptions you need to make in order to get that equation. We've learned that some problems can't be treated this way, and we have some idea about what to do when you can't treat them. And we've learned some new techniques and how they relate to this drift diffusion equation.